Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Adam Short, host of the Grit in the Wild podcast. Adam, it's good to be back and to be a grit in the wild, and I'm glad we can now advertise your podcast on here. It was good having your wife on and you to talk through that. Hopefully people are connecting with it, and I'll put the link into the description for those who haven't. But thank you for coming back, and I'm excited today to talk about IHOP and Bethel and everywhere in between.
Always a pleasure, and thanks for the plug to our little bitty podcast, Grit in the Wild. We're just kind of continuing conversations between my wife and I primarily right now, and just trying to really open the door, if you will, or pull the curtain back in our own experience and story of trying to navigate a lot of things, including spiritual abuse and our own experience, you know, toxic faith, and how that intersects and is continuing to intersect with the scandals that just continue to unfold and break, and many layers of these scandals, as we've talked about, and you're talking with others, so many other people who have firsthand experience with a lot of these leaders. And so, yeah, super happy to be back with you as always. And then, yeah, to cover and discuss some of the cross-pollination, I think, that, you know, that exists between places like Bethel and IHOP and other places too, but especially want to hone in on Bethel and IHOP connections, because those two orbits do overlap. It's kind of like if you can think of two spinning tops on a table next to each other, they're like spinning in their own orbit. They have their own ecosystems, but then let's say they're peeling off or spilling or spitting out electrons, and they're like the electrons that kind of radiate out from each of those tops. They intersect with each other. They interact with each other. And incidentally, there's a lot of back and forth influence, I think, between the two organizations and movements. So having been a part of both of those, it's interesting to think through how and why they're connected. Is it intentional? Is it accidental? Is it a little bit of both? And I don't know the answer to that, but I'm happy to talk through my unformed thoughts.
I use the phrase cross-pollination because they're two separate entities and they're cross-pollinating. And but really, it's deeper than that. So I have had conversations with Paul Kane and with people who worked with Paul Kane and surrounded him. And there appears to be more to the story behind the explosion of Bethel into what it became from what it was. I've got some of the history on my website. You can see how it began. Mm-hmm. It's just this little church, and then suddenly overnight it exploded. Well, it's that explosion that's interesting, and unfortunately, mm-hmm. every person that I've spoken with, they're a little afraid to come out and come public with their story of how that came to be. But mm-hmm. from what we can see on the, you know, that is published, you can definitely see that there was a heavy influence of the Full Gospel Businessmen's Association. You can find them holding FBGMI chapters right there in Bethel. Mm-hmm. I've got some of that in the newspapers on the website. FGBMI, Charles and I are going through this in the Revival History podcast, but they were a key player in helping organize and orchestrate large ministries, like Joel Osteen's father, for example. That whole Joel Osteen church would not exist had FGBMI not stepped in and funded his ministry. It's a big deal.
Did not know that.
And a lot of people don't know this. Charles and I just recently came out with this information, but it was founded by two people. One of them was tied to the Kardashian family, which we've talked about. Dima mm-hmm. Shakarian was the founder of it. Well, there was a co-founder.
Okay.
The co-founder was a Branhamite, and his family, many of his family, are still Branhamites to this day. He was from, I want to say it's like 15 miles from my house, and they have always had, within the Full Gospel Businessmen's Association, they've always had key figures who were associated with both the charismatic movement and strong ties to Branhamism. So when you bring all of that together and then consider that Paul Kane was William Branham's protege, and he was spreading, till the day he died, he was spreading Branhamism. Whenever you think of those connections and then think of how Bethel kind of emerged and blossomed out of nothing, it really makes sense if you put your focus on the Full Gospel Businessman.
Wow. Yeah, and that whole piece there, I had never heard of until, you know, you and I started talking and looking at some of your research. You know, this is an organization that many of us younger, and if I could consider myself in one of the younger groups, I'm not as young as I once was, as the country saying or the country song goes, but we weren't, like, I was not familiar with that organization until I came across your research. And it's just interesting to see that that is a integral part of the historical backdrop there. But like back to, you mentioned Bethel getting its start and exploding in influence and awareness across the charismatic and even beyond charismatic world now because of their music primarily. You know, historically, Bethel was an Assemblies of God church, and it's been, I think it was the 50s when that church was started. So it was a kind of a regular plain vanilla, as I understand it, Assemblies of God church, you know, through the 50s. And then it was around the 90s, mid 90s, when Bill Johnson's father, Earl Johnson, M. Earl Johnson, who was the pastor of Bethel before Bill was, it was around the mid 90s that I think, and I don't know the exact year, but somebody could look that up, that Bethel left the Assemblies of God denomination. And I understand it was an amicable parting, or, you know, parting ways, if you will. And then kind of coinciding with the Toronto Blessing, if you're familiar with that movement that happened in Toronto with John and Carol Arnott at the Toronto Airport, what is it? The Toronto Christian Airport Fellowship, or TAF or something like that. There was a kind of an outpouring that happened there around 1995 timeframe. Okay. And Bill traveled to that church in Toronto. And I might be getting some of the details off, but this is just going off of memory here. I don't have it in front of me. Bill went to, you know, some of those meetings at John Arnott and Carol Arnott's church in Toronto, came back to Bethel and Reading in the mid 90s ish. And because prior he was pastoring a church in Weaverville, California, which is up in the mountains in podunk middle of nowhere. They moved to Reading, and they sort of brought that, Bill and Benny and his crew brought that new expression of Holy Spirit, you know, being given the freedom to move in the church. And that's when Bethel, initially, what happened was Bethel actually lost a lot of attendees at that time. I think half of the people that went to Bethel then left because Bill made it his primary mission of the church to be revival, spreading revival. And so from like mid to late 90s, and then late 90s, around 1998, Bethel School of Supernatural Ministry was started. But it really wasn't until, I want to say probably mid-2000s, that Bethel really got on the map, I think, nationally and internationally. BSSM started to grow, more and more exposure of its influence made its way out into, I think, more corners of the church world. And then even beyond that, like after those years into the 2010s, Bethel really exploded. And I think one of the catalysts of that, and I'm curious to hear, you know, your take on these events, but one of the catalysts of that was Bethel Music. And because Bethel Music initially was kind of, you had Bethel Music, and then you had Jesus Culture, which was the youth organization, the youth group organization that Banning Leibscher kind of led from the beginning. Well, it developed into its own thing. A Jesus Culture actually became, in its own right, very influential, and it still is. And, you know, they produce tons and tons of music, as well as Bethel Music. You know, they have conferences, Jesus Culture in Sacramento, and even Jesus Culture there for a while was traveling to all kinds of different big cities around the country, and I think even internationally, doing conferences primarily geared towards the youth. So those are some of the big footprint sort of tracing back, if you will, I think just in my understanding and knowledge, now there's probably a lot I don't know, like you're talking about the FGBMI, you know, its influence and how it sort of, you know, set the stage for Bethel to be where it's at now. But I think if you take Bethel music and look at how the footprint has been expanded that way, but then also Bill's books have had incredible influence and, you know, they've been distributed very widely across not even just the hyper-charismatic church, but even into some of the mainstream, I think, evangelical streams, even though what Bill writes about in his books is very different than what you would find in your typical, like, evangelical bookshelf, if you will, like a bookstore at a Baptist church or a Presbyterian church. But I believe his books are pretty well known now, and even people outside of the hyper-charismatic church are aware of him, you know, by and large.
I would agree with most of that. It's like everything that I have studied, it's so complicated you can't really attribute to 3 or 4 or 10 factors. There are so many moving parts and pieces to the puzzle, right? But from what I can gather and understand, Bethel music was a huge part of it. Probably, I would say it's probably the biggest contributing factor. But beyond that, you know, as a businessman, everybody who's listening who's a businessman understands that in order to make money, you have to spend money. And in order to make large amounts of money, you have to spend large amounts of money. So there has to be a funding backbone to this thing, right?
Right?
I think the four gospel businessmen help establish that channel of money. I would say that it was probably a critical component just as much as the music. But the music drove the popularity globally because, as you said, you know, Bethel music was highly popular then and still is now. But beyond that, the timing of it all, as it is beginning to explode, and you have the Toronto Blessing happening and many other key contributing factors happening at the same time, people were looking for a new revival to quote-unquote replace the Latter Rain revival, something bigger, better, more wide-reaching, I guess, widespread. And Bethel, because of its musical influence and because of the timing, it all just kind of came together, it appears. And what's interesting is, so you mentioned the Assemblies of God, they were an Assemblies church. Mm-hmm. Whenever you study, most researchers who study the connections between all of this and the Assemblies of God, they go back to whenever the Assemblies denounced Latter Rain. And they clue into this, and they understand that, well, there's a separation there, so maybe it's not connected. However, many, many Latter Rain churches went against the Latter Rain instructions to avoid the Latter Rain movement, and you had what was called rogue districts and rogue states even. Indiana was a rogue state for the Assemblies of God, and they were supporting Branham all through Latter Rain, but the main headquarters of the Assemblies of God was denouncing it. So you had this tug of war that's happening. From what I can tell in the research, it appears that the Bethel Church, during its Assemblies of God years, was looking very favorably at the Latter Rain. Whether they were participating or not, it's hard to say without more information, but it appears that they likely were. So they had this background to signs, wonders, healing, ministries, and due to their popularity, due to that background, due to the timing of the Toronto Blessing, all of this just kind of came together, and then it exploded. Mm-hmm. And they were primed to be one of the key entities that would basically turn into the NAR.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they're at the top of the list from that standpoint. And it's interesting, too, because you look at the influential figures in the movement at large, right, going back to Latter Rain and then sort of the successors, you know, Paul King really being a huge bridge between Latter Rain and what we have today. And if you, you know, if you pull the curtain back a little bit more, you can see when we talk about cross-pollination between places like Bethel and IHOP, it's not accidental, I don't think, because the people that were very formative in sort of building the foundation for these organizations like Bethel and IHOP, we're the same people. I mean, even though Bill Johnson, to my knowledge, did not know Paul Kane. I don't know. Maybe you've seen research that says the contrary. But you fast forward in time a little longer or a little more, like into the mid-2000s, like around 2007 to 2011 timeframe when I was there, that's when Bob Hartley kind of started appearing at Bethel. And I remember hearing about Bob Hartley at Bethel. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I know this guy. I've met him. I met him in Kansas City when I lived in Kansas City. I met him in 2004. I went to his house and I kind of would like to share a little bit about that experience. But zooming out a little bit for a second, it's like you're at Bethel and you used to live in Kansas City and here's Bob Hartley. You're like, where did he come from? It was like the second wave of leaders that really solidified the connections between Bethel and IHOP. And you even had like worship leaders at Bethel Music who started at IHOP. And I can think of two right now that are very well known. I'm not going to mention their names. They started at IHOP and then they came to Bethel later. Actually, three. There's one I'm thinking of that I believe started at Morningstar. So you can see, like, even in the worship realm, like the music and worship realm, there was crossover and pollination or cross-pollination between these three meccas. And it's almost like all roads led to Bethel. Like, go west, young man. That's how I feel when I look at it. I'm like, here I was a teenager, you know, started my church journey as a believer as a teenager at Morningstar. Then I went halfway across the country to Kansas City, you know, had involvement at IHOP / Metro Christian Fellowship, and then went on further west to Redding, California, and became a part of Bethel. And so my personal experience mirrors some of the, you know, better known, more well-known people that very directly were, you know, connected to all three of those organizations.
And I think that's important for everybody to understand, because many of these people are going back and forth between many of these entities. That's what makes the NAR so powerful. It's the network. You've got this networking that's happening. And so the cross-pollination is much easier. As Bethel is growing and thriving and IHOP is growing and thriving, people can cross-pollinate. They can invite to conferences or whatever. I'm pretty sure Paul Kane spoke at conferences at Bethel. I could be wrong. Somebody could correct me, but I think I read that somewhere. And as this is beginning to grow and spread, what Bethel did that was somewhat different and unique is that they, like you said, tailored the message in such a way that they didn't come out as explicitly following the latter rain doctrine. Bill Johnson would come out and say things that were probably negative of certain aspects of it, but it became this hybrid, right? He hybrid the doctrine to where it was tailored to fit the newly rising charismatic revivals that were happening, yet while still appealing to some of the older Pentecostal ways. And so this blend began to happen that it really turned it into a new ministry and a new religion altogether. And then that started flowing through all of these NAR networks. So that began to spread, and we have something that's entirely different and new. I look at some of the doctrines that, like, IHOP KC's doctrines on the how the end of days would play out. Mm-hmm. If you were to be a Branhamite and come in contact with this, you'd say, no, this is a different religion altogether. That's not what Branham taught.
Yeah.
But then you look at the underlying foundation of many of the other things they taught.
Yeah.
It could not exist without Branhamism.
Yeah.
So it began to shift and change and evolve. And because it's cross-pollinating, you can't attribute the change to any certain church or person. They're cross-pollinating, they're getting new ideas, they're seeing, it's like throwing darts at a dartboard and seeing what sticks. They're, well, that one's stuck, let's choose that doctrine and go forward with it. This other one nobody liked, let's scrap that idea and go forward without it. And so in doing so, it created a new breed of charismatic person.
This stuff is so interesting to me, because what you're saying about if a Branhamite went into IHOP and said, hey, well, that's not what we were we believe about eschatology. So that would be sort of like a turnoff for them, right? They would turn around and say, hey, we're not going to be a part of this. But you're right. There are so many other commonalities. For example, belief in the supernatural, belief in encounters, belief in angelic visitations or supernatural healings, or the way that a human can be endued with such a high level of anointing that they sort of achieve almost a deity status. All of that stuff, there's commonality across all of these organizations. And as I've learned from you and others about what it was like in the William Branham movement, I'm flabbergasted as to how similar some of the stuff, even though practical like outworkings are somewhat different, but like there's definitely that commonality there. And which is wild, because it's like, in my mind, before I knew a lot about your research, and I've told you this before, you know, we were just taught at Bethel that William Branham just ended badly. And so we were like, well, just don't read the other six blue books, just read the first six. And so you just kind of thought, okay, well, leave off the parts of his life that were quote unquote bad, but then you keep the first six books, or the first, you know, part of his life. And the first, you know, section of his life really was the part that was so emphasized at Bethel. And, you know, I remember many times being taught that, hey, you know, we're seeking to have the mantle of William Branham. So there's another example of the commonality thread across these. But then I will say that when you compare IHOP to Bethel, the doctrines and theologies are very different. There are a lot of differences. For example, IHOP was much more of a inward focused kind of organization slash group, where, you know, it was centered around the prayer room. Everybody basically spent their time at the prayer room. You know, you had to do a certain number of hours every week at the prayer room. And that was really the hub and the epicenter of the organization, even though they had lots of other affiliated organizations and outreaches and stuff like that. The prayer room was really the hub. And I would say, in my experience, even though I was not formally a part of any of the IHOP programs, I went to the prayer room quite a bit and knew a lot of people at IHOP, and, you know, was influenced by their music and all that stuff. I would say that the overall vibe at IHOP was a lot more somber, and there was not nearly as much relational connection amongst the people that went as there was at Bethel. Like, if you compare that to Bethel, Bethel was very much outward focused. You know, it's sort of like this offensive versus defensive. Like, Bethel was constantly focusing on getting this out there to the world, influencing the Seven Mountains, getting out or getting people activated and released as kingdom carriers, you know, to get them out and to influence the world. And really, I mean, as the world looks at it, you know, it kind of looks like you're trying to take over the world. But there was a lot of community at Bethel that I think didn't exist at IHOP. But yet, even though you have those differences, there was still a very solid, like, commonality between the two organizations and networks. And so it made it relatively easy for people to go back and forth, whether you were just a lowly, no-name, nobody student or attendee, or if you were up the flagpole quite a bit like Bob Hartley. And I don't know exactly how he made his way into getting to know Bill and the upper leadership of Bethel. I don't know many of the details of that story, but I just know that towards the last couple years that we were there, Bob Hartley had more and more visibility at Bethel. I believe he spoke at the school. He would come into Reading and invite people to come over to a house, and he would prophesy over. As a matter of fact, my wife reminded me the other night that she was in one of those groups that was invited over. And, you know, Bob Hartley, you know, he basically has his laptop open and he's prophesying over everybody. And so it's very, very much kind of what Jed has described in his experience with his dad. Like, there's, you know, it seems like everybody's got a file on them, and there's this information, and, you know, you're getting prophesied over. And it's like, well, where did that information come from? Did you get it from data mining? Were you fed that information elsewhere? Did you get it from the dark side? Did you get it from the bright side? Is it a combination of all four, or is it another option that we haven't talked about?
Well, and the thing to understand is that the commonality between all of it is that the signs, wonders, so-called miracles, that was the religion. All of the doctrines come and go, change and evolve, but in the end, it's the focus on the supernatural that really binds all of this together. One of the things that kind of is a little shocking whenever you think about the complexities of it, William Branham's ministry began as the the spiritualist craze was happening in the United States, and there were people who were performing seances, and they were doing all kinds of signs, wonders, things that you might call a miracle, and mm-hmm. his ministry imitated that. And so the early years, the years that Bethel would say that this was when William Branham was a good guy, and then he later turned into a bad guy. Well, in his earliest form of ministry, he claims that his hand is changing colors to detect diseases. And if it turns a certain color, it's a color that God can't heal you. You're doomed. mm-hmm. You're beyond God's help, basically. mm-hmm. And so that stage act apparently didn't last as long. It didn't work. It turned into a vibrating hand. And he and Oral Roberts had a vibrating hand instead of a color-changing hand. And largely due to the fact that I'm certain it was the Kardashians that gave him this, but somebody gave him this very, very expensive watch. In today's money, it's like a $10,000 watch. And he claimed that he had to have this because the vibrating hand would break in a regular cheap watch like you and I might wear. So he had to have this very extravagant, very expensive watch. And, you know, it changed and evolved over time into various weird things. Like, he would go into this is on record, I think in one of his recordings even, he would go into a church and he would hold up a bracelet on a string and say, watch, the power of God can make this bracelet move, which is oddly one of the tricks that I learned in kindergarten. You kind of wiggle your hand a little bit in the bracelet. Uh-huh. People can't see it, but the bracelet's moving even though your hand is moving. But he's doing these kind of stage tricks, and that's the supernatural. Yeah. Well, the focus was, if you could elevate the people's faith enough to believe mm-hmm. that you had some wonderful gift, it was almost like a mind over matter thing. You could also convince them that they were healed. Combine that with positive confession, whether they're healed or not. If you can get them to confess they're healed, then suddenly everybody's claiming, oh, I'm healed, I'm healed, I'm healed, because everybody else is doing it, right? So you get into this hype, and then that's what they call a revival. Revival breaks out, everybody's seeing these quote-unquote miracles, and you cannot convince one person who attended that it didn't happen because they're watching everybody claim to be healed, whether they are or they aren't.
It's so funny you bring all this up, because I was just talking to Mike Winger this week, and I spent about 2 hours with him. Very gracious of him to give me 2 hours of his time. Got to talk with him about a lot of my experience in these movements. Okay. But one of the things that he's diving into, and I'm sure you're aware of this, he's looking at stuff like this, almost like these props, right? You mentioned the watch that William Branham wore. And then lots of people have seen that Mike Winger is looking into the clock that was in Bob Jones's hospital room right before he died. And there was this whole phenomenon where the clock started moving really fast. And the minute hand went around like this for several minutes, and it finally came back and stopped at midnight, I think it was, or might be getting the times wrong. But anyway, Bob Jones's wife was in the room, and this other man was in the room. They videoed the clock. They have video of it. I watched it last week. And, you know, they had this whole spiritual explanation for how the clock was moving only in Bob Jones's room, and that it was a supernatural message that was supposed to be, you know, broadcast and disseminated, and it meant this, that, and the other. And then, but Mike went down the rabbit hole, and he actually found out that it was a Primex clock, and that these are atomic clocks that have a receiver, and they receive a signal from a central broadcast, you know, transmitter, whatever, and that's how it syncs up. And so if the clock becomes out of sync, the clock has to catch up or get synced or whatever. So it'll, the minute hand will kind of do like this until it gets, you know, synced back up to the actual real time. But see, they created this bridge from a very realistic, explainable, logical phenomenon and created this entire spiritual message and explanation. So I was talking to Mike about this, and I mentioned about the these magicians, you know, people like David Blaine or Chris Angel or, you know, people like that that perform in Vegas. And I've been to a David Blaine show live, and, you know, David Blaine actually trains for this stuff. Like he's been able to go underwater for, I don't know, it's like a world record amount of time and not breathe. And they put him in like ice water and all this crazy stuff. And so there's a component of what he does, which is actually pure training and skill and endurance and stuff like that. It's not actual illusion. But there's other stuff that he does that I think is illusion and almost like a mentalist. I think there's an actual thing called mentalist. And it gets back to what you're talking about with, it's more than just sleight of hand. It's like you incorporate potentially things like hypnosis or you engage the power of suggestion or, you know, all these different things that can be done to sort of hype a person up or prime them to believe that something's happening when it may or may not be happening, right? And then the interesting thing is if you're hypnotized, you know, or if you have external influence that affects your autonomic nervous system, you actually can have a measure of improvement of symptoms in your body, whether it be pain or discomfort or, you know, stuff like that. You can actually feel improvement because that's just how the body works. Like, it's just, I mean, I think that's why some therapists use hypnotism to help you feel better. So I still believe that healings happen. I mean, I'm convinced that I did see healings happen, you know, over the years. But I also do think that there's a lot of this that wasn't what they said it was.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You know, I don't ever go too deep with my beliefs because I don't want to sway people in one direction or another. But one of the things that I do openly declare is that for the things that are supernatural that I believe in, I believe that God created this world with a set of laws that must exist. And they're like the laws of physics, for example. Anything that God might do, because it's happening in this world, it has to happen in a certain way, in a certain order. Otherwise, you know, you have a God of chaos. You have Loki, not the God of the Bible, right? And so I believe that there has to be, if something happens that is unbelievable, it also has to be able to be proven in a way that does not defy the laws of this world. And so The funny part is that clock, I've actually seen mm-hmm. those clocks. I have sat in a classroom and I've watched it spin. So I know exactly.
Okay.
I know exactly what he's talking about. But let's take the other side of the coin. Many of the people, sadly, who are in leadership positions in these types of movements have some sort of mental illness or mental conditions. I'm not saying mm-hmm. that all of them do. I'm not saying even, you know, Bob Jones, I think, admitted to some of this, but to some extent, yeah. there can be other things that are explained in that way. I had a right. great, I had a great uncle who had a clock, and his clock also spun like this. And he would tell us, and we'd be sitting in there, and he would say, and I was in the room the other night, and that clock just started spinning again, and so we sat there and we thought about it, you know, but there's a catch. This great uncle had Parkinson's disease, and it had really, really deteriorated his mind. And it started from a spinning clock, and we just kind of thought, well, he has Parkinson's disease. We didn't go any further with it. It ended up from the spinning clock to after it spun, and this was after he had been telling the story for a while, after it spun, the arms of the clock would stretch down and these little people would come out into the room and rearrange my room for me.
Oh, okay.
Now, see, we're sitting in a room listening to a person who has Parkinson's disease, and we know what's right. wrong with this story.
Yeah.
But the interesting part is because of the way that people in the Pentecostal and charismatic movements have been primed to believe and look for anything supernatural. Mm-hmm. If somebody's yes, a little bit exactly. off the rocker and they say something like this, they don't stop and think, is the person sane? Is it explainable?
Yes.
Can I
Oh my gosh.
Have I seen a clock like this before? I've seen this clock, man. yeah. But they've been primed to look so hard to find supernatural that they shut off all
1,000%. You are hitting on something that my wife and I are like really talking about lately. And it is, and we actually talked about this in our, I think it was our last episode. The best way I can put it is the bridge. It's the bridge that is built between explainable, tangible, logical, empirical experiences or circumstances, right? Like you mentioned, the clock is another perfect example of this. And there actually is a very logical explanation for this. But what happens is a bridge is built across that to then have a supernatural explanation for it. And here's the problem, though. When you attach God told me or I feel like God said blank, it's like, who are you to argue with that? It's like there's not really any objection you can have to that. You're like, well, okay, he had Parkinson's, but he loves God, so he must be telling the truth, you know, and his experience is, we can take his experience at face value. And so if you multiply that by thousands and thousands of people's experiences, what are you left with? You're left with a lot of stuff that is very questionable at best. And maybe down there is some legitimate stuff going on that's real. You know, and I mean, I've had legitimate encounters with God, but I'm not going to go push that on people and say, hey, your experience should be this way too, just because I had it. And that's where it becomes very dangerous and abusive, is when people start developing their influence and then they get bigger, 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 bigger. Their following gets bigger, their influence gets bigger. And then fast forward 10 or 15 years, and you've got people like Chris Reed and Bob Hartley and whoever else that they've normalized what they call their supernatural spiritual experience, and they impose that upon other people, and it creates so much harm, because if the people listening don't have that experience, they feel that they are less than, or they feel that they're not as spiritual, or they feel that they need to make up for the deficiency on their end by whatever the leader says they should do, like they need to pray more, or they need to go do more outreach, or they need to read their Bible more, whatever it is. And that's how you generate more harm, is you're putting people on this treadmill to try to get to some level of spiritual attainment that actually never can be done. And it's actually impossible. It's something that we as people have been trying to do since the Tower of Babel, where they built the tower, they're trying to get up to heaven to reach God. And that is the nature of religion right there, is it's man's attempt to reach God. And we'll never get there.
And now complicate this even further with the people who are deceivers who are in the group. So I told the story about the bracelet, right? And this is, again, something that I saw in kindergarten. The teacher did the same thing. We all laughed and we did it too. If anybody were to have attended a magic show back in this time when Branham is doing this, and some magician got up holding a bracelet and watched it move, they would say, their first thought would be, okay, how did he make that bracelet move? And if he tied it to a rafter and it's sitting there in front of him and he's yelling at it and they're trying to figure out, well, how did he make it move? Their first thought is going to be he's doing something to that to make it move, not he's got some supernatural power and God has come down through him and God is showing us the way, right? But because it's happening in a Christian church, in a Christian setting, these deceivers, they're predators, they're spiritual predators. They're using the people's lack of critical thinking to deceive them by their own minds. And that's what's really problematic, because there are things that happen that can't be explained. I've witnessed things that can't be explained. And I don't, because my focus is no longer on those things, I just think either one of two things. Either maybe it is explainable and I just haven't figured it out yet. Or, you know, Satan himself disguises himself as an angel of light to come and deceive people according to the Bible.
One
of those two things. I don't immediately go to, oh, well, that's a miracle, that's a sign, so therefore he must be of God, and ignore everything else that the man says that is anti-biblical. But the movement has been so conditioned to the point that the signs, wonders, miracles have become the God to these people.
Right. Oh, yeah. I was telling Mike Winger this week, and this is an observation that I had. I don't know exactly when, but it was during my deconstruction journey where it occurred to me over a period of time, as I compared the Gospels in the Bible, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you read the accounts of the miracles that happened in there, right? So like Jesus healed people, he raised people from the dead, he delivered people from demons. You know, recorded in the Gospels. Okay. Well, a lot of the time, what's interesting is Jesus told the people that were healed or delivered, or the people that actually were the recipients of the miracle, he told them not to tell anybody. Okay. But then later, it changed and he said, yeah, go show yourself to the priest, go tell, you can tell people. But who did the telling? This is what I told Mike. I said, who did the telling? Was it the person who prayed for that person who did the telling of the miracle, or was it the person who received the miracle? And it was the person that received the miracle who was telling the world about it. But what we've done in the hypercharismatic movement is we've made it about us, the quote-unquote miracle worker people. We want to go tell the story because it's another notch on the belt, and it props us up. It makes us look spiritual. It makes us be like, oh yeah, you're a whoop-de-doo miracle worker. And that is not the point of it. Like, that is actually not the point at all. It's not the point to take all of this recognition for something that you actually didn't even do. For the stuff that did happen, like, it's not up to, or it's not for the person to take credit for that. And I think you're right. Like, the miracles and the healings and the supernatural, those have become really the central fixture of the whole belief system and the whole, like, religious practice. And it's just like anything else that we put in the center of, you know, that we think's the most important thing. It's an idol. And God wants to be, he wants to be in the middle, not like, and you know, even if you don't believe in God, that's fine. I'm just saying, like, for people that believe in God, like, God should be the middle, the center of it, not some miracle or trinket that we carry around and brag to people about.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, because that, for me, that is the architecture of this thing. I've examined movements that pre-existed Branhamism, and I've examined movements that came after. And what I see is the shift in the idea that the miracles were designed to make the healer look more powerful whenever mm-hmm. you come into the Branhamism. And that architecture seems to have been carried forward. I know people really dogged me if I mentioned John Wimber, so unfortunately I've got to mention him again. His platform, whenever he started bringing all of this together, was signs, wonders, miracles, the feels, the feelings. And he's carrying it forward, too, in the same way. The irony is, if you study that trail, which I'm digging into just a bit, Lonnie mm-hmm. Frisbee was working with the shepherding guys who mm-hmm. were, in fact, he went to Don Basham, I think. Don Basham was his seminary teacher or something to that effect. I've got that research preparing it to be published. But they're working with the shepherding guys who were heavily influenced by Branhamism and the Branham style of charismatic preaching. It was also designed with authoritarian control, the focus on the gifts, the signs, the wonders, miracles, in such a way that the person who is preaching or doing them becomes more powerful, so that the people look for those people as their spiritual guides rather yeah. than empowering the people to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. When you examine some of the ministries that came before Branham, although I'm certain that there are some that were similar, many of them who went off into cults, they attracted their cult by telling the people that they too can do this, and the cult tried to do it, and then, you know, by and large, they could not do it. Carry the structure forward into the NAR today. Now it's the same exact thing. They've got the authoritarian style that came straight from the shepherding movement. They've got the focus on signs, wonders, miracles that empowers the leader that came from Branhamism.
Yeah.
And all of this just came to flourish at Bethel.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of sincerity, but just like with anything, you can be sincere, but you can be sincerely wrong. And, you know, if you're a low-level or even a mid-level person in that organization, you know, you adopt this way of life and this belief system, and just becomes a part of you, and it becomes second nature, and you're kind of propagating or duplicating it in your little bitty sphere of life. And, you know, I think a lot of people are sincere in those sort of lower levels, but then you do have people in the higher levels who are either intentionally and willfully blind, or they are intentionally involved in some dark stuff, like we've seen over at IHOP. I'm still reserving a shred of optimism that at least Bill is sincere. That's about as far as I can go with that.
Well, see, I come from a unique background, having been in close to some of the leaders of the Branham side. It's more complicated than a yes, no, on, off, either or. Mm-hmm. So my grandfather was also sincere, and I watched when he sincerely lied to the people to try to convince them of things that he knew was false, but yet at the same time, he sincerely believed other parts of it. So yeah. It's so complicated to understand the way that the mind works when you're in one of these things. Yeah. You become indoctrinated, you become programmed. Mm-hmm. Then some of the people who are programmed rise into leadership positions. They sincerely yeah. believe, some of them, the things that they see and hear and understand. However, they also, because they've been conditioned to try to orchestrate a miracle, orchestrate some sign or wonder, they'll go mm-hmm. to extremes to do that, with the understanding that if they can raise the faith of the people by some fake thing they're doing, they can bring forth a real miracle. That's what they've been trained to believe. So you've right. got this complicated thing where sometimes it's true, sometimes it's sincere, sometimes it's fake, sometimes it's fraud.
Yeah,
and sometimes it's predators, right? That they're doing this because they can get to women or money or whatever.
Exactly. 1,000%. I agree with you in every way on that. It is so complicated. And with the human mind, like a lot of us on Twitter have debated back and forth, like, and I think most of us agree that, back to Mike Bickle for a minute, like, we really believe that he actually is convinced that everything that he's taught is true. Like, it's, I mean, he's 1,000% convinced of it. Now, that's the thing about truth. You can be 1,000% convinced of it, but it doesn't mean it's true. You know, you can say to you're blue in the face that there's no such thing as gravity. You know, you can yell at gravity. You can curse gravity. You can throw rocks at gravity. But that's the thing about gravity. It's still going to be there. And you jump off a building.
Yeah.
You don't believe gravity exists. Well, it's going to be a rude awakening.
Absolutely. And there's also a deterioration of the mind. There are people who say something that's false enough that they too start to believe it. This is a phenomenon True. That Yeah. you can find in psychology studies. But I don't know. He may have been sincere from the beginning. I know talking with Bob Scott, Bob seems to believe so. There are people that I know who sincerely started out with good intentions and then just went down paths that I can't believe that they went down, bringing people Yeah. with them into their own destruction. And that's sadly what seems to be happening in a lot of these movements. And when you look at really, really large organizations like Bethel, where now instead of some small church where somebody's headed down to destruction, now you're talking about how many tens of thousands of people that are headed down the path.
Unquantifiable.
It's unbelievable.
Unquantifiable. Yeah. Well, and I think about too, like you look at the new building that they're building, and I think it's $100 million building. And, you know, they're well into that project. You can look on Google Earth or Apple Earth or Apple Maps, whatever it is. And you can see that, you know, the land is under construction or they're building there. They've got the foundations. And, but I am totally offended that we received a card in the mail several months back asking for money. You know, it was a card signed by Bill, nice, colorful, beautiful, glossy. And, you know, it had a thermometer on there. This is where we're at on the fundraising progress. We've got X dollars and we need X still. And I have no doubt whatsoever that they will fully fund the project. Like there's no scarcity of cash to my knowledge at Bethel. But like, what if you used that $100 million to do something else? Like what if you didn't believe that your building was the epicenter of Jesus Christ? Okay. And that in order for somebody to experience transformation in their life, they have to actually get on a plane or get in a car or get on a horse or train or boat or spaceship and come to Redding, California and come to your building, your brand new building, and you experience cancer healing or you experience financial healing or whatever it is. Why do I need to come to your church that cost $100 million to get my miracle? Like, that is the biggest scam in history. And I think it is an affront to the true gospel of Jesus Christ. And then set that aside for a minute. Even if you don't believe in God, it's still the biggest grift. It's still the biggest scam because you got people that are writing checks, running their credit cards, and many of these people are financially insolvent and they don't have enough money to pay their bills anyway. And you got all these people giving their money to an organization that is filthy rich. And I have a big problem with that. I think that it is wrong. I think that it shouldn't be allowed. And I think Bethel should give all the money back to their donors and not build it.
Well, and it defeats the purpose of, you know, the Bible talks about helping the poor and the widows. And we have a country that has homeless. We have a country that has widows. We have, like you said, the people who are poor sometimes are giving the money to the church. That needs to change. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that any church should be doing this either, but I'm not the one that makes the call for Bethel. So all I can say is it doesn't make sense. That's all I can say. But
well, anyway. It makes sense if you're at the top of that fiscal food chain. It makes a lot of sense because you're the beneficiary of everybody's generosity.
Absolutely.
And you get to be rolling in cash. And hey, you know what? If that's your jam in life to roll in cash, go for it. But why don't you do it and not take advantage of other people? Why don't you go invent like something that'll take us to Mars in 15 minutes? I'm pretty sure somebody would buy that.
I've got this, I don't know if you've seen it, but I've got this little channel where I do the funny satire news. And the one that I just did yesterday was the church in Mars. So,
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. I didn't even see that. That's totally coincidental.
Yeah, it's crazy. I should probably link that in the channel too for anybody that wants it. But anyway, this has been fun. Thanks for doing this and helping me explore Bethel and IHOP and everything in between.
Absolutely, John. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.